Hello and welcome back to the podcast. It is always up to speed with Formula One. And wow, I don't even know where to start on this one, Mark. We're like, I guess, what, 6, 10, 20 hours ahead of our usual recording schedule. But because of what we saw at Baku this morning, we just had to jump in and weigh in on what happened on the streets of the Baku City Circuit. The fun thing is that you and I have not really talked about this. You were rewatching the race as I was watching it. And, you know, you were not trying to give anything away. But it has been a really bizarre weekend in some respects, because we had 4 red flags during qualifying, which tied a record at Hungary, I think going back to, what was it, 2016 or 2017, something like that. And then the race itself was drama almost right from the very beginning. And, you know, my initial reaction after watching the race and after it was finally done, when we had that bizarre 2-lap start right from the end after the red flag, was it was like one of those movies that you go and watch and you think you know what's going to happen, and then you literally have to stay to the very end of the movie to know what actually happens. But it was a fantastic, lucky race for both Max and Lance, obviously, because, I mean, that could have ended a lot worse for both of them than it did. But it was very enjoyable to see that, you know, go down the way that it did with all the drama. But there's going to be a lot of questions asked about Pirelli. I mean, we should talk about that, obviously, but do we want to talk about qualifying? Do we have enough time to talk about qualifying? Because I think we should maybe just set it up a little bit, because I think that it turned a lot of heads to see Charles Leclerc on pole, because I received a lot of messages on the email about a lot of suspicions from some of our viewers and listeners as to what's going on with the Ferrari. And, you know, they've been not really there, you know, competitive wise over the past year or so. They had a good weekend in Monaco 2 weeks ago, but Monaco slow speed track, and it's a bit of a lottery. And I guess you could say that, you know, if anybody has a chance, Monaco is going to be the one track if you're having, you know, if you don't have the most competitive car, because you can get away with some things there. But that definitely turned some heads on Saturday. What were your thoughts?
I think before I even reflect on what we experienced over the last couple of days, I think we took a lot of heat coming out of Monaco, especially from some of our newer listeners, because I think myself especially, I built that race into something that it was never going to be. I talked about the glamorous history, and I talked about the setting, and then ultimately Monaco was a bit of a procession, which isn't super unusual for a dry race at Monaco. But for the better part of the last 4, 5, 6 weeks, we've been talking about that in the right circumstances, Monaco can be pretty unpredictable. It can be a little bit fun. But historically, Baku has always been fun. Mm-hmm. 2016, 17, 18, 19. Unfortunately, of course, we didn't get a race there last year. But every single time we've been to Azerbaijan, we've been to Baku, something exciting has happened. And I had a feeling, and I think a lot of us did, that even though it was going to be dry, there was no moisture in the forecast, and we've never had a wet race in Baku. And I can't even imagine what that would look like. But I think there was a sense that this could be a really unpredictable weekend. And part of that, of course, is that so many of the drivers on the grid have never been there. You talk about Nicholas Latifi, and you talk about Yuki, and you talk about MSC, and you talk about Mazepin. There's a lot of drivers that just have no familiarity with that track. And then likewise, there's a lot of drivers that have been there in the past, but in a completely different vehicle. So the weekend was shaping up before we even arrived to be something special. And I think the big distinction is, whereas Monaco is a tight, winding city track without any opportunity to overtake, this is a tight, winding city track with one of the longest straights in all of Formula One. So there's a ton of opportunity for overtaking. So it's a very, while it's a city track, it's a road track, it's very different fundamentally from a racing dynamic perspective. And I think the racing was fantastic today. And I think it's probably as good as it gets, again, barring the fact that there were some unfortunate DNFs, which I'm sure we'll get to. But I think to your point, there's definitely some value in teeing up what we saw in qualifying. And it feels like an eternity ago, but qualifying sure yesterday, right?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a strange weekend in that way. When I watched qualifying yesterday, I thought to myself, how can the race be even more dramatic than what we saw during that that 1 hour qualifying session? But I knew something was up when I went to go and watch it on F1 TV, and I saw the length of what the qualifying session was. I'm like, okay, something went on. I'm sure there must have been at least a red flag in here somewhere, but there were many. And it was the usual kind of thing, people hitting the barriers at turn 15, which seems to be a bit of a notorious corner now. I mean, we have the Wall of Champions in Montreal. I mean, this one's developing a bit of a reputation on its own. I mean, it was very unfortunate. I think that Lance went off, and he was the first victim to go out in qualifying. Sure. And that really looked like it was going to ruin his race. And fast forward to today, I mean, he was looking pretty good. I mean, kind of going for a bit of a different strategy, starting on the hard tires and trying to go deeper into the race. And he was progressing, fairly well through the pack. And I think that really kind of goes to show you, when it comes to Azerbaijan, to that circuit, that, like you say, although it is a road circuit, it's very different from very other road circuits, because it almost has a purpose-built racetrack feel to it in some regards. That very long 1.4 mile straightaway at start finish, that doesn't really feel, it doesn't have a road circuit feel to it, let's put it that way. But the way that they've been able to build this course and kind of link it together, I think it has a good mixture of both, say, a traditional racing circuit and also a road track as well. And, the thing is, I mean, apart from that very, very narrow twisty section by the castle there, is there are plenty of opportunities to overtake on this circuit, and not necessarily down start finish, which I thought was really, really cool that we saw this this weekend. Is we saw many drivers overtaking one another without necessarily having to use the benefit of DRS. I mean, it's usually a benefit, but it wasn't always on display, which I thought was really cool.
One of the takeaways I had from this race, and it was unfortunate that it became red flag, which we'll get to, but it was kind of like the event following the restart after the red flag was kind of like a mini Grand Prix in itself. Mm-hmm. And because it was so short, the drivers just went for it. And you're absolutely right. I think the perception going into this event is that long straight offers overtaking opportunities, but that's in particular going to be for the Red Bulls, the Aston Martins, and the Mercedes-Benz cars, the cars that have a ton of top-end power and some really great downforce. But I think what we saw after that restart, we saw Gasly and Leclerc fighting, we saw Lando fighting, and that wasn't necessarily on the straights. That was on the city streets portion of the racetrack. But I think they've got something really special here. And I have to say, this is probably the event that I maybe now look forward to most on the calendar. I love Spa. I love Canada. There's a couple of other events. But just because of the unpredictable nature of this track and that it offers a little bit of everything, to me, it's super special. The other thing, too, is I was talking to somebody that was actually at the event this weekend. And one of the things I was most curious about is when you see these street tracks, the surface itself typically isn't great. It's a little bit uneven. It's a little bit a little bit rough. And the challenge with those uneven, rough surfaces is the contact patch of the tires isn't particularly consistent. So the tires don't heat up, which means that the brakes don't heat up, which means they don't have a lot of traction, which means they tend to understeer going into corners. But based on the feedback that I got from some of the folks that were there, the actual surface for the race portions of the track was exceptional. So the surface, and you can actually see it on some of the tighter angle shots of the track, the surface was exceptional. So I can't say enough good stuff about F1 and the race organizers for putting on this event. Unfortunately, of course, there was nobody in attendance except for some of the lucky residents whose balconies hung over the track, which was amazing. I'm sure there were some really great Airbnb opportunities this weekend, but again, I can't say enough about the track. I think the unpredictability offers a really compelling viewing opportunity, and I think that's 100% what we got today.
Blue Flags and Brian McCarthy weighing in the live chat on YouTube, saying that they really enjoyed this one, and Brian saying amazing, totally unpredictable, and so exciting. Yeah, 100%. And the one thing that while we were sitting there in that delay right at the end, as they cleared up the debris from Max's accident, was I thought, well, you know, what's the point of running a couple of laps there? But I'm glad that they did, because I think that in a very small snapshot, it kind of gave us maybe a bit of insight as to maybe what we can expect from the sprint races, right?
Oh, that was my point. I had that right here.
I stole it, but okay. Well,
I love it.
Rather than me stealing your thunder, why didn't you run with it? Because I think that it was really cool, because I was watching with my wife and she said, this is going to be great because now there's no strategy. They've all got fresh tires. They've got enough fuel to get to the end of the race. It's just going to be two laps completely flat out. And I thought it was great.
No, I think you nailed it. And I think it comes down to this. At the beginning of the race, it was funny. I'm sitting there with my wife, just like you, our poor wives are subjected to so much Formula One racing. But we're sitting there. And I'm just like, you know what? I just wish the race was an hour. I think that comes from having watched a lot of really boring Grand Prix over the last 6 or 7 years. I didn't want to be subjected to an hour and 40 minutes of procession. And one of the things I really love about MotoGP is those races are tight and compact. And it's partly because of the physical nature of the sport. 20 laps, 40 minutes, those riders are done. So for me, I was hoping for kind of a compact event, but you're absolutely right. And one of the notes that I made is that that two lap restart was very much provided a little bit of window or insight into potentially how the drivers could psychologically approach a qualifying sprint race, or I keep getting that mixed up. People keep correcting me, Mark, it's not a sprint race. It's not a qualifying sprint race. It's a sprint qualifying event, but I think you're absolutely right. And I think if it's a short event and it's tight, it's going to provide a ton of unpredictability. And I think it's going to be very, very, very exciting because I think what we saw in that ever so short snapshot of two laps is hopefully what would be extrapolated over potentially 20 laps of a qualifying sprint event.
You know, the other thing that I found very interesting about this one was what with all the drama late in the race, what with, you know, first of all, Max having that tire failure and then the crash and then the red flag. And then at that point, I thought, okay, well, now it's just going to be default. Lewis is going to overtake Perez on the restart. Nobody expected Lewis to have that incident that he did. I mean, his brakes looked like they were going to catch on fire right at the start. There was so much smoke coming off. Turns out that when Perez deked to the left, that Lewis took evasive action. He hit that magic button, which you know, switched the brake balance, and it was just everything. The brake balance all went to the front rather than the rear brakes weren't engaged at all. So he just overshot the corner into that runoff area, and then what turned out to be basically worst case scenario for Max Verstappen and his championship aspirations almost became a bit of a moot point because Lewis finished the race in 15th position, behind his teammate who was completely non-existent all race long, which was shocking. Goodness. But it was really something. There's a great point. Benjamin Nelson weighing in on the live chat says, such a fun race to watch. I realize this won't be the norm, but it will be great to witness. As Gen DTS, I have to go back and rewatch the 2019 German Grand Prix, which I think is a great comparison to make because that was a bit of a wet race and a dry race and a lot of drama. Everybody went off at one point or another. And I think that's a great comparison to make with the 2021 Azerbaijan Grand Prix. It was just drama and from start to finish, basically.
I know we're probably going to have to cut to a break here, but because I had so many people asking about brake magic and the magic brake button, and it was referred to in about 27 different ways over the course of the last 6 to 8 hours, it's interesting because one of the things that Formula One has always tried to do is instill a degree of competitive balance. Despite the huge budget disparities between the teams, Formula One has always fiercely outlawed what they consider to be driver aids. So we're talking about things like four-wheel drive. We're talking about driver controllable center differentials that could move torque from one quarter to other or front to back, traction control, all of those kind of pieces. But one of the functions that has been allowed, and most of the teams have some variation of it, is this function called brake magic or a magic brake button. And what it's designed to do is be activated during a warm-up lap or a formation lap. And effectively what it does is exactly what you said, is it shifts all of the brake bias towards the front brake. So when you're going through that slow formation lap, or you're going to going through a lap while you're following a safety car, the biggest concern in those moments is for the car to be at optimal performance. The tires need to have a ton of warmth in them and the brakes need to be warm. If your tires are cold and your brakes are cold, you're not going to be able to brake into the corners. You're not going to be able to get grip. You're not going to be able to get traction. And then if you go into a corner and your brakes are cold, your brakes are going to be far less responsive. So in essence, what this mode does is it sticks all of your brake bias to the front wheels, or about 75% of it. So when you're going on that formation lap or that safety lap, every time you hit your brakes, it's basically overloading the front corner. And that's fine because during a formation lap or a safety lap, you're not racing. So it doesn't really matter and it's controllable. So what Hamilton was doing by activating that previously was just trying to get some temperature into those front brakes and those front tires. The problem is he left it on. So when the race started, he went into that corner fast. He had Sergio Perez, but when he went into that corner, like you said, all the brake at that point went into the front two wheels. They promptly locked up and he slid off. And fortunately, there was no barrier there, so we went into that runoff area. But the problem was, because he didn't turn it off, none of the brake bias went to the rear wheels, so it wasn't balanced. All the brake went to the front. The front's locked up. They got a flat spot. Basically, his race is done. So it's a driver aid, and it's weird that it's allowed. But what it's really designed to do is that during those formation laps, when you're following a safety car, it allows you to get some warmth into those front brakes and those front tires. So when racing does commence, you're not going to be as cold and you'll get a little bit more grip.
Yeah. You know, when I heard about this one, my immediate thought was it's like engine party mode, but for brakes, you know,
and yeah, then of course, exactly.
the party mode was banned. Was it last year or the year before? I mean, it's been out for a little bit. Hey, Mark, let's take a little bit of a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk, we need to talk about this podium. This was a pretty interesting podium, to say the least. And we'll talk about that in a moment when we take a break here. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show, and welcome to everybody listening to the podcast. Welcome to everybody watching on YouTube, especially those of you who are watching live. It's finally cool to be able to do this and have some interaction with you guys in real time. So, Mark, let's just quickly run down the race classification. We probably should have done that first, but, you know, drama and lots of other things. So it was not to be what we thought it was going to be. I mean, up until what was it, lap 44, lap 45, when Max had his accident, it looked like he was gonna walk this one home. Anyways, the final, we'll run down the 10 point pain positions. We had Sergio Perez winning this one for Red Bull. Sebastian Vettel winning this, coming home second for Aston Martin. Pierre Gasly coming home in third for the AlphaTauri. Charles Leclerc fourth for Ferrari. Lando Norris recovering nicely after getting that three-grid place penalty for that transgression in qualifying. He came home fifth. Fernando Alonso coming home quietly, I would think, in sixth. I think that's the best way to describe Fernando's afternoon. Yuki Tsunoda recovering nicely after a couple of rough weekends in recent times. He came home seventh. Carlos Sainz, he recovered nicely to get back into the points after that unfortunate off that he had down the escape road there when his tires were cold. He came home eighth. Danny Ricciardo, another guy that had a bit of a quiet afternoon, he finished ninth. And then rounding out the top 10 was Kimi Raikkonen. So a bit of a different top 10. Let's just quickly recap the driver's standings. Max Verstappen still on 105 points, 4 points ahead of Lewis Hamilton, who's in second with 101. Sergio Perez is now third in the championship with 69 points. Lando Norris, fourth in the championship with 66. Charles Leclerc, 52. That's good enough for fifth in the drivers. And Valtteri Bottas, a distant sixth, 47 points for the Mercedes driver. And the constructors, now this is where it's getting a little bit interesting. Red Bull now, after six races, 174 points in the constructors. And that puts them up, 26 points on Mercedes. They have 148. Ferrari sneaking third into the constructors with 94, 2 points ahead of McLaren. And then AlphaTauri rounding out the top five with 39. First of all, your thoughts on Sebastian Vettel and Aston Martin getting that second place? I thought that it would need something to be a little bit dramatic, because it looked like at one point he might be able to get close to Lewis Hamilton. Looked like he was lapping about half a second a lap at one point prior to Max Verstappen's accident and the red flag. And then he started to lose place or lose a bit of pace, and he dropped back from that that pair of Lewis Hamilton and Sergio Perez. But I think it was the result that he needed to get a bit of his mojo back. Especially, I think it was important, a big result to get for Aston Martin.
To me, there's absolutely no question that this is his best performance since probably 2018. I'm obviously ecstatic for him. I'm absolutely ecstatic for the Aston Martin team. I don't think that this result was by any means a fluke. I think his pace from the jump was exceptional. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen him look this racy again. Like I said, maybe flashes early in 2019, but certainly not since probably the midway part of late 2018, have I seen him so racy and so aggressive. He was challenging in the corners. He was looking for overtaking opportunities. Every time he was in the DRS zone, he was stepping out, looking for an opportunity to overtake on the inside, on the outside. He just looked thoroughly engaged as a race car driver. And I think now he's at that point where it's clicked. He's comfortable with that car. He's comfortable with that power unit. The confidence is there. And I think this is fantastic, not just for him, but I think it's also fantastic for the entire Aston Martin team and the factory. And you and I talk so much about how imposing Lawrence Stroll is. I think it must be really tough to be a mechanic or an engineer knowing that he's looming in the garage during every event, right? It's tough to be working when your boss is right there looking over your shoulder. So I think for that team, that mentally, psychologically, this is going to take, it's going to take a little bit of the edge off. I think it's exceptionally unfortunate that Lance's day ended the way it did, and we'll get there in a moment. But I think if we zero in on Sebastian Vettel, I couldn't be more ecstatic. And I don't think I would... You know, if you flash back to 2010, 11, 12, 13, when he was running off those four straight drivers' championships for Red Bull, looking very dominant. Again, a couple of years, it was pretty close with Fernando Alonso, but in at least two of those years, he absolutely ran away with the championship. I never thought that there would be some point in the future where I would be so happy to see him score a podium. But I think given the challenges that he had in his second to last year with Ferrari because of the cheating scandal and the kind of the relationship issues and the friction that became so obvious when he was racing alongside Charles Leclerc. I couldn't be happier for him. And I think this is a really, really great way to re-energize him and to re-energize that team. But I appreciate you asking the question, but I just think this result isn't a fluke. He was racy. He had pace and he was aggressive in a way that I haven't seen in years. And I was ecstatic to see it.
Yeah, I agree. I 100% with everything you just said. I think that I was a little bit... I wouldn't say disappointed, but I thought that 11th in qualifying wasn't probably the result that he wanted. However, he made up for it, and he gained three places very early on in the race, and he was looking really quite racy. And I thought that it was a really interesting little battle that was going on there between himself, Gasly, and Tsunoda. I think Leclerc was in there at one point, yeah, as well. That whole group, it kind of mixed itself up a couple of times. I thought it was really, really good. But the thing that that really struck me at the end was that after the race was over, you could hear the relief. You could hear the joy in his voice. And I think it was maybe a bit of a... It might have been an aha weekend for him that he still got it. Like you say, he's finally comfortable in that car. And I think for Lance, that must be a huge disappointment, because starting so far back and the strategy that they went for, I think that that Aston Martin are going to be very, very disappointed. Obviously, relieved that that Lance is okay. But I think they wanted to, and they should have had both cars in the points.
Absolutely. I have to admit too, and I'll eat a little bit of humble pie here, but on Saturday I had put up a tweet indicating that the weekend was turning into a bit of a horror show for Aston Martin. As you mentioned, despite the fact that this is a car that's very much tailor-made for a track with a straightaway like this, and to give a little bit of context, one of the strengths of the Aston Martin car is it's exceptionally good in long-distance straights. The top speed, the top end is exceptional. So it was a little bit disappointing that he couldn't get into Q3. It was also very disappointing that, and again, I think we talked about it earlier, turn 15, I think Lance had contact. He didn't finish a lap during Q1. Red flags came out. It was looking like a horror show. And I put up a comment, and one of our listeners at Azam responded right away. He made a really good point that this was a team that was still in a position to score a lot of points if they could be competitive on race day. And just like you said, very, very quickly, both of the Aston Martin cars were in the points. And if not for the fact that our good friend, Canadian boy, Lance Stroll, had the misfortune of what we now believe to be a tire failure, both of these cars would have been deeply embedded in the points and done really well in the championship this weekend. But unfortunately, that wasn't to be. But that said, I think Sebastian Vettel was exceptional.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've gotten to the point of the show now that we need to talk about Pirelli and what happened with the tires, because I think when Lance had his incident, he was 29. I think he had 29 laps on those tires. And I think that they were rated for about 40 laps. Yeah. And then also with Max later on, they said they had no warning that there was anything going on with the tires. I think that was the same thing with the with Aston Martin. But just really shocking. I mean, it was either like a complete failure of the tires, or they struck some debris, which I think that they found out there was a cut in one of Lewis's tires as well.
Yeah, and I think when the Lance incident happened, I think it was around lap 30. I think to provide a little bit of context here. So when tires are under maximum load, so when we talk about load being applied to a tire, it's the moment when the absolute most forces are being applied to that tire. So typically it happens in one of two places: in a really aggressive high speed corner, of which this track really doesn't have any, or it's when the car is near or very much at top speed on a straightaway. Because while the car is at top speed on a straightaway, there's a tremendous amount of downforce being applied to the car through the aerodynamics. That downforce is then spread to the suspension, which then applies it to the tire. So at the moment that Lance's tire came apart, and I think we now know that maybe there was a debris issue, I think Pirelli's suggesting that that's the case, what we do know happened is that the sidewall of the tire separated from the rest of the tire. And we now suspect that conveniently that was a complete tire failure, because it happened at the exact moment at the point on track where the highest amount of load would have been applied to the tire, when a tire would be most susceptible and vulnerable to a tire failure. We've talked about this a lot, but go back and revisit the 2005 USGP. And then what made the Max situation so interesting is that he had effectively the exact same failure on the exact same tire, on the exact same compound, on the exact same corner, at the exact same point of the track. So with Lance, it sounded like the announcers, the broadcasters at least, were leaning into the fact that potentially this was a puncture due to some debris left on the track from a previous incident. But when Max had the exact same failure at the same place on the same corner with the same compound tire, hey, it's no longer a question of whether this was debris left on the track. And I think for our listeners as well, when we talk about debris on the track, it's usually not metal, it's not stone, it's not rock. Typically, the type of debris that's on the track that causes the most issue in terms of punctures to tires is chunks of carbon fiber. So the front wing, the side pods, the floors, the rear wing, it's all carbon fiber. And when carbon fiber explodes, it goes into millions of pieces of shards. And these shards can pierce right through rubber, right through tire. So the assumption was with Lance, at least the race organizers, at least the announcers at Sky Sports were kind of leaning into the fact that, hey, this was probably a puncture. But as soon as it happened to Max, the benefit of the doubt shifted, like, hey, this is no longer a puncture. This is a tire failure issue. And I think what's going to have to happen over the next couple of days and weeks is a really thorough investigation, both by Pirelli and the FIA, because this isn't even a competitiveness issue. This isn't even a sporting issue. This is a straight up safety issue. And I think we take for granted that both of those drivers got out of the car. Lance was clearly shook up. But when you have a puncture at that type of speed, it's very, very easy for these cars to be thrown into the catch fence on the side of the track. And fortunately, that didn't happen. And it didn't happen in part because the cars were so close to the walls when it happened. So they didn't have the opportunity to get lift and go into the air, but it very easily could have happened. So at this point, it looks like Pirelli is still arguing or still of the belief that this is a puncture issue. But I think all of the evidence suggests that this was 100% a rear tire failure when the inner sidewall separated from the rest of the tire at speed at full downforce.
Yeah, you know, it really is interesting too that it was the left rear tire on both of those cars. And of course, this circuit does run counterclockwise. So there was a lot of left hand turns, obviously. And the first thing that I thought of, I was a little bit, obviously, quite shocked what happened to Lance. It was unexpected, all of because of the way that the TV feed went was all of a sudden there's Lance's car and
yes,
there's stuff flying everywhere. Yeah. And, you know, he's just sitting there, obviously, like you say, shaken up. I mean, when you saw the pictures of him back in the Aston Martin garage, I mean, he looked like somebody that had just been through something. I mean, he looked he had that sort of deer in headlights, kind of glazed look on his eyes. And then the same thing that happened with Max, it was almost a carbon copy of what happened. And then I thought to myself, you know what this reminded me a lot of was that incident that Sebastian Vettel had at Spa. Was it back in 2016?
Yeah.
Towards the end of the race. However, I think the difference in that time was I think that Ferrari actually pushed those tires beyond the suggested life of the tires. But you know, like we were saying just now, that Lance, his incident happened when I think he had about 29 laps on those tires when they were rated for about 40 laps. I'm not sure where Max's were, but like they said from the pit wall, I thought it was interesting that they did include that that radio message from the Red Bull pit wall to the race director saying, you know, we had absolutely no warning that this was going to happen, that there was no indication that there was any issues with those tires and until it happened and he was into the wall. And I thought that, you know, very much like you say, it's a safety issue because that's what they said, you know, you should consider red flagging this race immediately so everybody can come in and change their tires, either that or, you know, stop the race. Right. I mean, especially at that point, this was not a low speed corner. This is, like you say, at maximum load. They're doing 200 plus miles an hour, and they're just fortunate that those cars didn't go up into the fencing or roll or something like that. I mean, they're both very fortunate that they came to a relatively quick stop.
It's important to understand as well, and you've hinted at this a couple of times, that when Pirelli provides the teams with the tires, they provide them with an operating range. So they say, in these conditions, at these temperatures, at this time of day, the optimum number of laps would be this, or they provide a ceiling and a basement. In both the case of Lance and in the case of Max, the teams were well within that range. Like, they weren't pushing the range that Pirelli had provided. They were both in the safe zone. Now, here's a fairly alarming comment that's being reported, but Mario Isola, Pirelli's head of Formula One, is indicating that early evidence suggests that debris was the cause of the two tire failures at Baku. He also suggested that Lewis Hamilton had been fortunate to avoid the same fate because they discovered a cut on his tire. So at this point, and I think things are probably going to change in the next few hours and days, and we'll probably talk a lot about this on Thursday, but at this point, Pirelli's official position seems to be that these weren't tire failures, that these were punctures. It's just, for me, almost impossible to reconcile what I saw with what he's saying. The fact that the exact same failure happened on the same corner of the same tire, of the same compound, at the same speed, at the same point of the track, it just, it seems absurd. And the other thing too is the teams have telemetry and data. So if the tires have a puncture, it doesn't normally immediately lead to a tire failure. They'll see something in their data to suggest that there's an issue with this tire. And both in the case of Aston Martin and Red Bull, the engineers saw nothing to suggest that those tires, the integrity of those tires have been compromised by track debris.
Yeah, I mean, you raise a great point. I mean, it happened virtually at the same point on the track under virtually, say, the same conditions, right, and circumstances. And of course, this is a track where we see a lot of drama. And, you know, out of every track, I mean, there is going to be a good chance that people are going to be touching the walls and the barriers and losing bits and pieces off of their cars. And, you know, the carbon fiber, when it shatters, it's very, very sharp. I mean, that's a logical conclusion. However, if it was solely because of a debris that was collected, to me, it would be a little bit more random. It would have been, it could have happened like around the circuit. I mean, the fact that these happened within a couple hundred meters of each other on that start-finish straightaway, and like you say, the sidewall separated the way that it did, it just... it just takes credibility away from that that explanation. I mean, there might be something to it, but I'm very skeptical about that. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, I don't have a lot more to add other than the fact that I'll be very interested to see how this plays out over the course of the next couple of days. The one thing that I should add as well, and this is important for folks that are newer to the sport, but historically, Formula One has had multiple tire suppliers. So teams would negotiate with different companies to be a supplier for that team. And in the past, you've had Michelin and you've had Goodyear. Formula One's kind of in a unique place right now where they only have one tire supplier. And I'll be very honest, I feel like in many ways, Formula One needs Pirelli more than Pirelli actually needs Formula One from a marketing perspective. We know that Goodyear and Michelin were a part of the Formula One world going back years and decades, and both of them opted out. And there was a very specific reason they opted out. So I think from a Pirelli perspective, this is really, really unfortunate, and hopefully they're very transparent with their findings. But ultimately, Formula One's also in a fairly vulnerable position because there's only one manufacturer that seems interested in supplying this series. But ultimately, that shouldn't have an impact on what the outcome, the honest, transparent outcome of this investigation is. And if it was due to track debris and a sharp piece of carbon fiber that compromised the structural integrity of that tire, which led to the tire failure, so be it. Let's see some evidence. I don't believe that's the case. And I think there's still two more events that I was reading where a similar mix of compounds, the C3, C4, C5 is going to be delivered. That's going to be at Russia and at Abu Dhabi. But I think at least in those two cases, there's no point on either of those tracks where the tires would see the same load that they saw in the straight. So maybe the risk isn't as high, but certainly something to consider. And I'm sure the FIA and Formula One, the team, and Pirelli are going to be regrouping over the course of the next couple of days.
Well, I'm going to disagree with that to a certain extent because at Sochi, we do have that very long start-finish straightaway as well, where they come out of a fairly slow speed corner just after the pit entry there. But it is interesting that that it is the softer compounds in the Pirelli range, the C3, C4, and C5, so they're softest tires. So they're going to have to do a lot of thinking and soul-searching and investigation into what really happened. Anyways, Mark, let's take another quick break here. When we come back, I think we need to talk about Valtteri Bottas. I think what we saw today is a pretty good indication of that things are probably starting to come to an end for him, unfortunately, at Mercedes. And we'll talk about that in just a moment.
So,
yeah, it is, isn't it? So don't go away. We'll talk about that in just a moment.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right. Well, welcome back. You're with Mark and Mark. Again, we're talking about the Azerbaijan Grand Prix and all the drama. We did talk about the final race classification. Well, I mean, poor old Lewis Hamilton didn't really work out very well for him. It obviously did not work out very well for Max Verstappen. We have to talk about the championship implications or the bit of the stalemate. Lewis, after it was all said and done, ended up in P15. The thing is that his teammate, Valtteri Bottas, finished in P12, and he just struggled all race long. I mean, he didn't really qualify all that well. He qualified in what? Was it 10th? And then just, I know that there was probably a bit of the team game going on there, giving Lewis a bit of a toe, which kind of helped, although they never really did get a chance to set those final hot laps at the end of Q3 because of the crash there, just one of many. But you just have to think that maybe, sadly, the writing on the wall is there for Valtteri Bottas. I know that we've talked about it. We've kind of made a little bit of light of that situation. at times. But I'm going to go back to the point that I've made, you know, despite some of the, you know, poking fun at him a little bit, maybe then making light of, you know, the so-called championship contender and stuff like that. The thing is that since he joined the team in 2017, he's done absolutely everything that he's needed to do for that team. He's brought home so many points for them. He's helped them win championships. He's won a bunch of races himself. That, you know, unfortunately for Valtteri, the winning the world championship was probably just a little bit too far beyond his grasp. But just the way that things seem to be unraveling in real time, I just don't have a lot of confidence that that they're going to renew that contract for him. And now I'm starting to get a real bad vibe that maybe he doesn't see out the rest of the season.
I couldn't agree more. And for those of you that listened to us on the Thursday show, we actually talked about this a little bit. If you haven't heard, I still recommend you go back and listen. It hasn't dated. It was more kind of like a standalone, show that just kind of assessed the current state of Formula One and all the great things that the sport's been doing from a growth perspective. But our guest during that show, Matt Sakaris, had actually made the comment that he didn't believe that Valtteri Bottas would finish the season in a Mercedes car. And I'll be honest, man, at that time, I didn't disagree, but I kind of thought it was a bit of a hot take. And after this race weekend, I no longer think that it's a hot take. I think he was genuinely onto something. And I think for Mercedes, when you're talking about the Constructors' Championship and now also the Drivers' Championship being on the line, and with it, tens of millions of dollars of prize money and sponsorship money, you can't afford to continue to put somebody in that seat that maybe is, and this is going to sound so bad, but maybe has some psychological damage or baggage. And obviously the crash in Imola, that wasn't his fault. He got collected by Russell and he went off. The pit stop fiasco in Monaco was super unfortunate. The team still decided to assign at least some of the blame to him, which was unfortunate. But his pace and his performance in Baku was just unacceptable, from free practice to qualifying. And to your point, he qualified 10th. He had opportunities to pass. He wasn't racy. He didn't seem aggressive. And I think the other consideration too is, and I don't want to get super technical on this, but it looks like he and Lewis had diverging opinions on which wing they were going to put on their car for the race. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, Valtteri Bottas decided to go with a bigger wing, which isn't necessarily what you would bring to a track that has a really high speed section, because that bigger wing creates more drag, which doesn't allow you to be as fast on the straight. And I think based on some of the documentation and evidence I suggested, that could have been costing him as much as a tenth of a second per lap relative to his teammate Hamilton. But ultimately, wearing that wing was still his choice. The driver decides which wing is going to be on the car. Like, to me, the entire weekend was really problematic. And for me, if I'm Mercedes and I wasn't confident in bringing him back, and obviously they weren't because he's not under contract for next year, at this point, why do you let him ride out the season? Why not look at doing a driver swap with Williams right now? You take Russell, you put Williams in the, or you put Bottas in the Williams car. There's some cash that's exchanged as well to compensate for the size of the Bottas contract. To me, it almost seems logical that this is going to happen. And again, maybe Bottas runs off three straight podiums going into the summer break, or three or four top five finishes, and the conversation changes, but I just haven't seen enough yet to suggest that that's the case. And even in the three podium finishes that he had a podium in Bahrain, he had a podium in Portugal and in Spain, relative to the number one and two spots, he wasn't even remotely close. He wasn't contending to win any of those three races.
Yeah, you know, it really is interesting when you look at it. And you bring up a great point, just that, you know, the comments that Toto Wolff made after Monaco, that Valtteri wasn't squarely in his marks for the pit stop, where they, you know, that wheel nut shredded and basically dustified when they put the wheel gun onto it. It was almost like one of those situations that when you get rear-ended in just a normal traffic accident, it's like the insurance company automatically assigns you like a very small percentage of the blame just because you were physically present, even though you didn't actually, you know, somebody else drove up the backside of your car. But I thought that was very funny, because that he should say that, because, you know, Valtteri, I mean, in his rebuttal to that comment was, well, I've gone back, I've looked at the video, and I'm pretty sure I'm spot on my marks, you know. So I thought that was a very interesting indicator that maybe things aren't really quite, you know, stable or hunky-dory, whatever you want to call it, behind the scenes there between Mercedes and Valtteri Bottas, which I think is a shame if it turns out that way. I mean, we've talked about it that obviously that he's not the long-term solution to that team, but there is no doubt and no taking away what he's done for this team over the past several years. And honestly, I think it would be a real shame if they were actually to pull the plug on him halfway through the season. I know that, George Russell's been making noises that not necessarily that he wants, that Mercedes seat. I think everybody wants one of those Mercedes seats should they become available, either one or both of them at the end of the year. But I mean, you can understand from George's point of view that he's kind of languishing a bit when you see like a lot of those other guys in his same age group, like Pierre, like Charles, like Max and Lando, all getting these opportunities while he's languishing at the back of the grid in the Williams. So I mean, he's obviously going to be gnashing at the bit and chomping at the bit, ready to get into a better car. It's just. And unless they become desperate, and if you read some of the comments that Toto is making in the media after this race today, that these past two weekends are unacceptable, and when they're like they come out and say all the time that they're chasing perfection, that these two past weekends have just been disastrous and unprecedented since 2014.
Yeah, two thoughts, and I don't disagree with anything that you said, but I think the first thought is, it would be very unlike Mercedes to make a change like that. In a lot of ways, they have very much been the benchmark of consistency and stability over the course of the last 6 or 7 years. They're not reactive, and partly because they've never really needed to be reactive. They'll have a bad race and they'll make some adjustments and they'll adapt and make changes, but they're not typically super reactive and don't overreact and make emotionally driven or emotionally charged decisions. I think that might change here. I would add, though, that there has been some interesting comments from Toto directed at Christian and the Red Bull team for some of their midseason driver swaps over the past couple of years and some of the kind of fallout that that's led to. I think the other consideration is this. If you're considering George Russell, but you're not absolutely convinced that he would be the right fit for your team, why not let him finish the balance of the calendar? Give him 10, 15 races in this car. And if you like what you see, then you can commit to a contract. Because I think that would probably logically be a really wise look. Because right now, he's in a car that is so uncompetitive relative to the rest of Formula One that it's very difficult to establish just how capable he is as a driver. And of course, he's been pre-assigned and preordained as the replacement for either Lewis or Valtteri Bottas if that seat becomes available. But again, we don't necessarily know what he's capable of. And he's done some testing in the Mercedes. Obviously, he had that opportunity in Bahrain at the back end of last season. And it was kind of a disruptive affair because of some issues in the pit, et cetera, blah, 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 blah. But if you're considering giving him a contract and you don't really know what his capabilities are because he's never been in a competitive car for more than a single race weekend, why not make that change now? Let him finish the balance of the season in the car, and then you'll have a really clear perspective on whether you do want to commit to him for 1 or 2 years, and then you can sign him to that contract. But if you put him in that car for 15 races and he's equally as uncompetitive as Bottas, or he's not showing the same flashes that you would have expected based on where you thought he was, then you're not making a mistake by committing to him for 1 or 2 years. Like, to me now, financially, logistically, it just makes sense to make that change, because you might be eyeing George Russell at the end of the season, but he's still something of an unknown quantity simply because he's never driven a competitive car for an extended period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got a couple of points that I want to make, and we'll do so. We've got to take another quick break here, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. So stick with us, guys. We're not going anywhere. I felt cheated after 51 laps. I felt like this race should have been extended. I know it wasn't possible. So we'll go a little bit longer tonight. We won't deny everybody else the opportunity to revel and enjoy
Four
this
hours.
One. And
we'll here we go. Go.
4 hours. Here we go. 4 hour extravaganza. And we'll come back in just a moment. So don't go away. All right, well, welcome back to the show. We're talking about Mercedes now. We're talking about George Russell. We're talking about Valtteri Bottas. And Mark, you raise a couple of really good points. And I don't think that there's a question that George is a very talented driver. But like you say, he is an unknown quantity. And I think that what Mercedes should do right now is I think they need to step back and take a real objective look at this and try and cool the situation, because you have George on one side saying, I want my future, sorted out by the summer post 2021. Valtteri saying the same thing. And, they're not really coming out and saying, Mercedes, I want my deal by the summer break. But I mean, they kind of are in a roundabout way. I think what they need to do as an organization, it would make sense to put it off until the end of the year. I mean, there would be nothing worse than to make a rash decision and switch it around. I mean, Red Bull's done it several times now. And the only time it really worked out was with Max Verstappen. And Max was obviously, he was a bit of a gamble. I mean, he was obviously very talented at 17 or whatever it was when they put him into that car, but it absolutely was a big gamble. And what they've tried to do with Albon and what they did with Gasly, that obviously didn't work. And it seems that Perez is starting to settle in. It's taken him several races, but I think that he looked great during this race. I mean, the qualifying was, I think you got to put an asterisk beside that just because of Yuki's crash and then Carlos trying to take evasive action. And then just with less than, a couple of minutes left, they just, canceled and red flagged the entire session. So that kind of, I think you got to put an asterisk besides Sergio's qualifying this weekend. But in the race, I think he did very, very well. But I mean, if you see what, you take that sort of Red Bull situation, what they've had, that sort of rotating driver situation with driver number two over the past couple of years, that would be very un-Mercedes-esque, right? Because
very much so.
They threatened to do something when it got nasty between Lewis and Nico Rosberg at sort of that peak venom toxic situation that they had. And I mean, Niki Lauda said it at one point, Toto said it at one point, that we will not hesitate to cancel one or both of these drivers' contracts if they can't learn to get along and at least function so we can do what we need to do, and that's win races and win championships. I mean, ultimately, I think there was some sort of uneasy truce or stalemates declared, and I think they just got on and at the job at hand. And I think he very much had one side of the garage for Lewis, one side of the garage for Rosberg. But I mean, the one thing that is unusual is that they are not used to being in this position in the championship. Is it over and done with? No. I mean, we're only six races into a 23 race season. Maybe we'll see how it turns out at the end of the year. But the point is, there's still a lot of racing to go. And Lewis is only 4 points behind Max in the Drivers' Championship. I mean, by rights, he should have been a lot further ahead of Max after this one, but drama. And then in the constructor's side, Sergio did everything that he needed to do today. He stepped up and he managed to, I mean, he was obviously benefited from Lewis having that incident at turn one on that restart, but he was battling issues of his own because, I mean, he was ordered to stop the car because of a reported, I think it was hydraulic issue. And they were actually thinking of retiring that car at one point. So it's turned out to be worst case scenario for Mercedes, could have been worst case scenario for Red Bull. But at the end of the day, Red Bull and Max Verstappen come out much better off than Mercedes. And the point that I'm trying to make sort of long and roundabout is that even though it would be very unusual for them to make a driver change mid-season, that they are in an unprecedented territory. And if this sort of run of poor results continues and they see that gap, especially in the constructors continuing to grow, that who knows? That I think that's a bit of an unpredictable and very hard situation to make a call on, especially on the outside, right?
Absolutely. And I think the way you summarized it is perfect. This is unprecedented territory for the Mercedes-Benz Formula One team. They are now, they're still second in the constructors, but they're 20, to your point, 26 points behind.
Yeah, I think it was 26. Yeah.
But I think more importantly, they have 1 point finish in the last two Grand Prix. So aside from all the mayhem and all the craziness, you know, Lewis was in a position where he should have won the race today. And that was driver error. That was straight up driver error. His teammate had a horrible performance. That was driver error. That was all Bottas. And again, you know what? You could attribute some of that to the setup of the car. But again, he had FP1, FP2, FP3, and qualifying to sort that out. And they didn't sort it out. And he was terrible in the race. And I don't attribute that entirely to the wing. I don't attribute that entirely to the setup. I think that's a large chunk Bottas. Like, this is just unprecedented territory for Mercedes. And what makes this different is that in the past, they've had some bad races, right? Like we talk about Germany 2019, that wasn't a good race. Bottas touched some paint when the track was wet and he spun out and he was done. I think Hamilton finished 9th or 10th in that race, but they rebounded. Mm-hmm. And typically Hamilton does a really good job of rebounding after a tough performance and typically winning. But you look at this season, he had a bad performance in Monaco because he finished P7 and he was very critical of the team. He was very negative post-race in ways that we don't typically see from Lewis, because he'll typically assign credit to the team, but he'll also take blame when he feels it's necessary. But post Monaco, he was very critical of the team and he kind of reeled some of that back in over the next couple of days, but he didn't bounce back in the way that you thought he typically would have here. And again, a big chunk of this is a single error at the end of the race, but it doesn't explain the Bottas performance. It's just, it's unprecedented for this team and it's good for the championship. Like, don't get me wrong. I am not releasing white doves into the sky to mourn the death of Mercedes-Benz, right? This is what we all want. We want a closer championship. We want some parity and we want some excitement down to the wire. I think what we're saying here is that based on everything we've seen from 2014 onwards, this is unprecedented. And it's good for the championship. It's good for TV viewing and it's good for everybody watching at home. It's just unprecedented. And maybe this is a bit early, but maybe this is the end of Mercedes as we know it, especially as Red Bull continues to come into form and as Perez gets more and more comfortable with that car. He won a race 3 weeks ago. We were talking about whether this was the right decision, whether he'd be back next year. He just won a Grand Prix with Red Bull, his second in what, 8-9 months? That's fantastic. And Ferrari's been a little bit racier than we expected. And Aston Martin is starting to show some flashes. I think the championship is going to be competitive, maybe in ways that we didn't expect. And I think our expectation was it's going to come down to Lewis and it's going to come down to Max. And it probably still will for that driver's title. But I don't know what it's going to look like from a constructor's perspective. And maybe it could be a little bit less clear than we would have thought. And again, that's good for all of us at home, because if Ferrari and McLaren and now Aston Martin are chipping in and stealing away some of those constructor's points every single weekend, it just makes the chase at the top that much more interesting.
You know, I want to get your thoughts on this, but watching this race for at least up until the point when Max had his incident, that I felt like I was watching like a body swap or a role reversal, because I thought that the two Red Bulls looked really, really good. And then Lewis was kind of in that Max Verstappen zone, right? Or where Max used to be, kind of in that close, but not quite close enough. I mean, the one thing that I must admit with Lewis's car, I found that his straight line speed down that start-finish straight was jaw-dropping. I mean, the way that he was able to really close up to Valtteri even before he hit that DRS zone, I thought was very impressive. I mean, pardon me, to Sergio. Yeah. But then it was interesting, when you got past the start finish and you went through turn one, the other basically 75 or 80% of the track, Sergio was just able to just increase that gap enough just to keep Lewis at arm's length. I know you had that second DRS zone after turn two between turns two and three there. And Lewis would kind of close back a bit, but then, you know, Sergio was able just to eke it out just enough that Lewis did have a couple of looks here and there, but it never really got to the point that I really felt, oh, this is the point that he's really going to make it stick. And I think that, you know, to your point that this is the second race that Checo was won in the past year. I think that although it was great, I thought that it was wonderful that he won that race at Sakhir at the end of last year. This one, I think, was more impressive, especially after I hear afterwards. I mean, it was astounding to see how the air went out of, no pun intended, went out of Red Bull on the pit wall. I mean, the body language and the way that they looked defeated. I mean, just from Max going and kicking the tire, to the way that Christian Horner was literally slumped over the console in grief almost, was, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. Not especially in recent times. And then you hear afterwards that, that Sergio was battling what was, I think it was like an undisclosed or maybe unconfirmed hydraulic issue. I think is just even that more impressive. I mean, of course, he didn't have to fight off Lewis over those last two laps after that restart incident, but you know, still, I mean, you had a very pacey looking, you know, Sebastian Vettel behind him, and, you know, he had a very pacey looking Pierre Gasly. I mean, if that race, if that red flag happened, maybe a lap 40 or 41 with 10 laps to go, who knows? Maybe that was Sebastian Vettel on the top step. Maybe Perez doesn't even finish that race. So I think that obviously that there were several outings at the beginning, incidents at the beginning of the year that I wouldn't say didn't endear himself to the team. I think that's maybe going a little bit too far, but it certainly wasn't what he wanted to deliver, and it wasn't what the team really needed. But I think by saving this victory, which was so cruelly snatched out of Max's hands, he still brings the win home for the team, and crucially, he brings home those 25 points in the Constructors, because I think that Paul Di Resta said it right after Max's incident there, that he said this could be a championship-defining moment. And it could have well been. Of course, Paul didn't have the benefit of having a crystal ball to see what would happen after the restart, but the Drivers' Championship is still wide open. It's still completely in play, as is the Constructors' Championship. But, you know, you just have to keep that in your mind for the time being until it swings dramatically one way or the other for Mercedes at Red Bull. You know, come December after Abu Dhabi, this could be one of those moments that we look back at, this period in May and June that could have potentially cost Mercedes a Constructors' Championship.
I'm going to take a bit of a Jim Rome, Colin Coward hot take on this one, but
have a take, don't suck.
I don't see how Mercedes comes back from this. And you're right. Like, if you look at the Drivers' Championship, it's just a couple of points. If you look at the Constructors' Championship, it's 26 points. It's not crazy. I just feel like all of the momentum is in the favor of Red Bull right now. All of the momentum. The one question that this team had all year was, is Sergio the right fit? Is he going to find a comfort zone in this car? Is he going to learn the car? Are they going to be able to adapt the car to him? Clearly, that's happened. Despite the fact that qualifying wasn't great, his race performances have been very, very strong. So if I'm buying stock in one of these two teams, I'm selling off my Mercedes stock and I'm clearly loading up on Red Bull stock. Like, that's where all my confidence is right now. And to kind of address your point too, you're absolutely right. When Max went down, I think the mentality in that team was, we just lost the ability to pick up 10 or 15 points on Mercedes. And to your point, they couldn't have known what was going to happen with Lewis, but ultimately the results swing right back in their favor. And it was really great to see. It was great to see at that podium ceremony that Max was standing there right between Christian Horner and Helmut Marko, cheering on the success of Sergio Perez, because that victory for Perez was as much about the team's fortunes as it was even Sergio's personal fortunes, right? He ultimately put 25 points between them and Mercedes in the Constructors' Championship. So for that team, despite what happened to Max, it's unfortunate, but it was a great weekend overall for Red Bull. And from a Max perspective as well, I feel heartbroken because, and they were talking about this on the Checkered Flag podcast, and Jenny Gow was talking about this, and Julian Palmer and everyone else, he didn't step a foot wrong all weekend, and he drove a masterful race. And when he was on the track, he was regularly 3 or 4 seconds up on his teammate, Sergio Perez. And you're right, Hamilton was keeping... He was keeping Sergio honest, and he would have an opportunity to get close under DRS on that straight. But as soon as they got into, and I call it kind of the city section of the track where they're kind of fighting in between the buildings, he would grow that lead again. And then they get on the straight and Hamilton would close it up a little bit, but Sergio wasn't giving him the opportunity. But yeah, I don't know where I was going with that one, but I just feel like Mercedes is in a much more profound position right now. And I'm much more worried about Mercedes than I certainly am Red Bull. Red Bull seems to have the momentum, and it seems like the one puzzle piece they'd yet to figure out, which was that Sergio piece, they kind of slotted into place this weekend with that race win, despite the fact that Max wasn't able to finish.
The word that immediately pops into my mind regarding Mercedes is they look vulnerable.
Yes.
And that is, that is not something that is not a word that has ever popped into my mind ever since, I would say, after 2014, after it became clear that this was the team to beat. I mean, they've been literally bulletproof for almost a decade now, which is, you know, amazing. But that's why I was saying a little while ago that it seemed like it was a bit of a role reversal. I mean, those two Red Bulls looked like they were on rails. And you know, I'll be completely honest, like, I think I'm probably speaking on your behalf as well, that prior to the season, I really got emotionally invested into Aston Martin. This was the team that 100%. I really wanted to see do well. I mean, there was the, you know, the sort of redemption story with Sebastian Vettel. You got the Canadian connection with Lance Stroll, you know, the local boy, so to speak. You got the Canadian connection with his dad, and the fact that, you know, for all intensive purposes, that we're going to call it a Canadian team. I'm coining trademarking the phrase now, Canadian Racing Green, although I might get some disagreement on that. But anyways, that was a team I really wanted to see do well. But this race hooked me today. And I was really found myself pulling for Max. I found myself pulling for Sergio. I found myself really pulling for Red Bull to take this home, to collect the maximum points, because you saw Lewis wasn't quite able to, you know, really make a move on Perez and get past him and really attack Max. You saw Valtteri slowly slipping back through the race order. And it just had that, it was, I guess, because it sort of adds to that bigger narrative that it adds more in terms of the fascination and the way that this championship or the championships are developing, that if it finished that way. And then when Max crashed, I was like, oh, here we go again. Lewis is going to walk and he's going to inherit a race victory that he doesn't deserve. And I must admit, I felt deflated. And then, you know, we have that, that 15 or 20 minute delay as they cleared up all the debris and removed Max's car from the track. They go back around. I thought, well, what is this going to be? Is this going to be like a, you know, rolling start, standing start? It turns out to be a standing start. And I'm really fascinated. I'm really into it at this point, that we're going to see basically this two lap sprint. And then, you know, the race restarts. And then it looks like Lewis is going to take that, that position. He goes wide. And then you see all these things happening. You see all the cars switching position there. And then you got Sergio leading, then you've got Vettel, and then you've got Gasly. And I'm like, I don't want this race to end in two laps. It should be automatically extended another 25 or 40 laps or something, just because this has been the best race of the season
and
so far.
And you say that, though, and I wrote this down. At lap 15, I was already saying, I wrote it down in my notes, at lap 15, this was the race of the year. And none of what we've been talking about had even happened yet. It was just, it was very racy from the beginning. You saw Hamilton pass Leclerc, and you saw Max pass Leclerc, and you saw Stroll move up five spots, and you saw Vettel move up a bunch of spots. Like, it was a race. Overtaking was happening. And somebody just popped up on our F1 feed here as well. F1 Fred from Yorkshire. This reinforces everything that we're talking about in terms of being the championship being more wide open than we've seen in many years. But he puts here, here's how many points Mercedes had scored after six races in the hybrid era. So 2014, they had 240 points after six, 2015, 242, 2016, 188, 2017, 179, 2018, 178, 2019, 257. That was their best start of the hybrid era. 2020, 221 points. And so far after six races, 148. So when we talk about the championship being wide open, hopefully this provides a little bit of context relative to where Mercedes was at this point in the season in all of the years preceding this during the hybrid era.
Yeah, you know, that really is fascinating when you look at it. I mean, even this time last year, I mean, that is a big, big difference. 148 points compared to 221. I mean, they really were on fire literally in 2019 and 2020. But it really... those numbers are really staggering when you see them in black and white. You know, that is an amazing stat right there. You know, it really, really is.
Yeah.
Hey, so I think we're getting to the point where we're going to wrap it up. But before we go, I want to end it on a bit of a fun note. We got a comment here in the live chat from Brian McCarthy. He says, what's the best race to go to in Europe? Can't wait to go to my first race. Silverstone is the closest race to me, but not sure if it'd be the best first race ever. We've talked about some of the, some of our choices, I think, before, but sort of in general. I think for me, Spain is still a good one. Because Barcelona is it's only half an hour away. It's easy to access by shuttle buses and things like that. That's what we did, and it was literally hop on a bus and you're there in half an hour, and the bus drops you off like it's a 5 minute walk from the front gate entrance to the circuit. Another one I would love to go would be to Monza, just for the experience. You know, when fans are allowed to go and watch races in person again. And another one that I don't actually know anybody that's been personally, but I've heard anecdotally that Hungary is a good one to go and attend, because Budapest is fairly accessible and is within about, I believe, half an hour of the track. And from what I understand, that is maybe a bit of an underrated, I don't want to say undiscovered tourist destination in Europe, but you know, from what I've read from, you know, just doing some researching on my own, that it seems to be a bit of a underrated, you know, place to go to in Europe as well. I'd be interested to hear some of your takes as well. I mean, some of the other ones, I mean, Silverstone's difficult to get to. It's out in the country a bit. Spa would be a wonderful one to go to, but again, it's out in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, it can be a little bit difficult to access, especially if you're driving into the track. And it's not like there's lots of hotels close by. I think a lot of people go there and camp. So interested if you've got anything to add to that, Mark.
Really. And we've talked about this a bunch of times. I think our listeners know I'm a huge fan of Silverstone. I've been there many times. I've seen MotoGP there, Formula One. You make a great point, though, that it is a little bit detached from an urban environment. It's about 40 minutes outside of Milton Keynes and probably an hour from Oxford. So if you stay at a hotel, expect that you're going to have quite a drive in. And if you go early in the morning, even on race day, you'll be able to get in and get your parking spot quickly. And I would suggest don't try to get there later than 7 or 8 a.m., to be totally honest. Otherwise, you're going to be facing hordes of traffic, because there's really only two routes in and out of that track. You can also camp at the location, but for people like me, that's a non-starter. I'm not going to camp anywhere. So for me, Silverstone for sure. And before we do wrap up, I have a couple of Twitter questions for you.
Sure.
Are you ready to take one?
Yeah, I'm going
for
it.
Okay, so I'll make this one quick. So this is from our good listener. I didn't realize he changed his Twitter handle, but Bitter Pittsburgher, how big was this weekend for Perez as far as his Red Bull F1 future is concerned?
I actually have to reread that, because I know that's Brad, and I think that you've started something with him, so you got to reread that one to me again.
No worries. How big do you think this weekend was for Perez as far as securing his future with Red Bull?
Yeah, I think it was massive. Yeah. I think that this was the weekend that that he needed. I mean, I know we were just really going on about how massive this weekend was for Sebastian Vettel. I think this was equally as important to Sergio Perez. I think that he's proven to himself now, okay, I'd won a race. Maybe that was a little bit fortunate that I did so last year, but not really. I mean, you don't just fluke out and win a race. I mean, you know, circumstances aren't that easy in Formula One at the best of times. And I think that he's proven to himself that that he can do it under pressure. And I know that, like we said, he's sort of struggled from time to time, you know, throughout the first five races of the year. And he's been close to putting it together. But I think this was the most complete weekend that we've seen from him so far. And I think that he did a phenomenal job to really... I don't think that maybe he intentionally was, you know, slowing down or, you know, behind Max, but I think he did. He was just pacey enough to keep Lewis behind him. And certainly at times that gap grew. And I think that I don't think he really felt intimidated by Lewis. I know that Lewis had a couple of looks on him, and I think that he can take a lot away from that, from this weekend. And build on it. I mean, when we go to France, to Britain, to Hungary, some of these races that we have coming up over the next month and a half, 2 months before the summer break, I'm excited to see where it's going with Sergio Perez. And I think that it was a great weekend. And I think what was also really interesting to see that in the paddock there after the race, that not only was he high-fiving, hugging with his pit crew and with his team, there was also, you know, a good exchange with some of the guys from Aston Martin, which used to be Racing Point, which was the team that he raced for a couple of years, a number of years, actually, and won that race at Sakhir last year. So I think that as a testament to what kind of a person he is and how much he's liked within the paddock. And I think that, you know, if you're at Sergio Perez right now, I think this is, you know, you're in a pretty good place. And I think you're eager to get going to the next race weekend and do it all over
Absolutely.
Again.
Two more quick questions. So I'll take this one and I'll pass one to you. So this is from listener Joel Plorde. And I apologize. I'm terrible, terrible, terrible with last names. Why didn't Lewis just try to finish the race? So this is the restart after the red flag. Why didn't Lewis just try to finish the race and grab some points instead of gunning it at the restart? So I think the consideration here is that theoretically, Hamilton has the fastest car. And I think the mentality at that point is you're never going to lag or intentionally have a slow start when the lights go green. It's psychologically, it's just not in his makeup. So the lights go green, you're going to go full throttle, wide open into that front corner. The other consideration is, and I get where he's coming from, which is, hey, you know what? He committed to a risky maneuver when he could have just cashed in on some points. I think the main main consideration here is, one, he's potentially got the fastest car. He's the best off the line in Formula One. So in normal circumstance, he would have kind of cleared that corner and been in the lead and finished the race. Unfortunately, there was the mistake with the magic brake functionality and setup on the car. But I think the other consideration too is the main reason you want to get a jump on everyone else is you don't want to be in traffic as you navigate the first and second and third corner. Because if you're navigating those corners while you're packed in traffic and you're going to those corners three or four cars wide, you're ultimately at the mercy of whatever mistakes those other drivers might make. So the risk is that if you don't try to jump out in front of the rest of the pack, you could get caught up with other cars and get collected into a collision or an accident or have your race compromised that way. So I think what he did in terms of just trying to jump ahead of the traffic and avoid that mess going into the first and second corner was absolutely the right thing. And then one more question for you. This is from Rene Cairns. I have another question. A lot is made of the toe/slipstream in qualifying that offers enormous advantages. But normally in a race, I often hear about drivers not wanting to be in the dirty air behind a car because of grip and tire wear. But there would be a slipstream then as well, right? So why is being in someone's slipstream not something they want unless it's the Baku straight?
Yeah, well, I mean, normally you're going to get issues like the heat that's generated from the car in front of you is going to overheat your tires, is going to overheat your brakes if you're behind there for like a prolonged period of time. But when it comes to like a very short stint behind the car in front of you, especially if it's one of your teammates and perhaps you're setting it up, I mean, this is something we also see in Russia at Sochi, is that you're letting the car in front of you punch a hole in the air. And, you always hear about like the slipstream and the toe. And effectively, it's, you're doing less work to punch that hole in the air. There's less friction. So your car is going to go a little bit faster. So you got to find that that sweet spot where you can get the benefit of the toe and not be either too far or too close to the car in front of you. And certainly it does have benefits. I mean, that is one of those places like in Russia that, that is like a known tactic. And at Azerbaijan also as well. I mean, it does, feature in some of the tracks throughout the calendar, not all the time, but if you're sitting behind a car in front of you during a race, it is certainly not the place to be, especially if you get to one of those situations where you're kind of close, but not quite close enough, even with a DRS to be able to overtake that car in front of you and then, push up the track and try and make a move on the car in front of you. Did you want to add something to that? Because I also want to just circle back for a moment. And I just wanted to say something about that one from Joel as well. Because
I'll just add quickly to that one. The best way, the way that I kind of think about this is, imagine you're running down the street and you're holding an umbrella behind you. Like, all of that air that's getting caught up in the umbrella, that's like the drag and that's slowing you down. Now, if you were running behind somebody holding an umbrella, well, that umbrella has already done the work because it's already capturing all that drag. So if you can get into that tight pocket in that car in front of you, like you said, that car is doing all the work to punch a hole in that air so your car doesn't have to do it. So you can kind of tuck in. Your car's not doing as much work and then you have that opportunity to step out. Now, if you're two or three or four car lengths behind that car, you're outside of that pocket, you're outside of that slipstream. So you're now getting the dirty air that's waving off of that car and bouncing all over the aerodynamics of your vehicle. But go on, please.
Yeah, could you just set up that one there from Joel again? I just want to make sure that I get address all those points because there's a couple of things I had pop into my head when you were replying to him.
Yeah, so let me just bring Joel's question up here again. So Joel's question was, why didn't Lewis just try to finish the race and grab some points instead of gunning it at the restart when the lights went green?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. And so a couple of things on that. I totally agree with you, what you're saying, that it's just not in his makeup. I think that he saw blood in the water. He decided to go for it and try and get maximum points to not only just to close that small point deficit that he had to Max coming into this race, but extend it, or close that and extend on Max and really inflict maximum damage on Max. But just on the flip side of that, just going back to the start of the race itself, you know, Max starting third behind Lewis, behind Charles, who was on pole. I thought that Max played it very conservatively, didn't try to get too close or get mixed up in anything at the beginning of the race, especially through that first lap or two when it can be quite chaotic. And especially on a track like Baku, that it can get very chaotic. I thought that it was interesting to watch because to me, it was an indication that that he really seemed to be playing the long game. And I think that it's interesting to see because not to suggest that that Max isn't a smart racing driver, but I think that it's just another indication of where he's really starting to mature, that he's I felt that it was a real conscious thing that he knew that that this race was probably there for the taking. If he just waited and just bided his time to the, you know, the you know, just waited until the moment presented itself. And I mean, let's not forget, I mean, the one thing that we have to, that we've been completely remiss and negligent not to address thus far is the fact that when it came to the first round of pit stops, when they changed from the softs to the hard tires, that Lewis went in, had a howling bad stop of 4.5 or 4.6 seconds, which wasn't necessarily the fault of the team. It was just that one of the AlphaTauris was coming in at the same time, so they had to hold Lewis in his pit box for a second or two longer. But then you have Max coming in the very lap afterwards. He had a real flying lap around there. He went in, Red Bull did what they do best. They had a sub 2 second stop to get all four tires on Max. He goes out, and when he's coming around, he's going into turn two as Lewis is just coming around turn one. And then, you know, on race radio, you have an astonished Lewis. I mean, his eyes must have been huge when he saw where Max was. And he said, how's he so far ahead of me? I mean, it was I think was one of the, you know, astonishing moments from the race. And I think that that's why it was, you know, if you're a fan of Max, it was doubly hard to watch that crash of Max's, just because they did everything right on and off the track to get, you know, to win this race and for Max to win this race. And it was just so cruel to see that, you know, that, that incident when his tire deflated and completely came apart like that, because he did everything right. And the team stepped up big time to give him a great stop, because Sergio didn't get a great stop when he went in. He was at about 4.5 seconds.
Yeah.
As well.
Two other comments I want to add before we sign off here, because I thought they were fairly interesting. One is, and I don't know if you picked up on this, there was a point where they broadcast some of the radio when Lando Norris was on the radio. And I guess at this point, he'd just come out of the pits and he was behind Bottas, but he'd made a comment to the team about how many errors, mistakes that Bottas was making. He'd made a comment, and I'd written it down, but I can't find the notes here, that Bottas is making mistakes all over the track, which I thought that was very interesting that another driver would share that observation. Obviously, he didn't know it was going to be on TV, but that he shared the other observation. The other thing, and we didn't touch on this, is definitely recognition for the AlphaTauri team to a fantastic weekend. The fact that they take a podium, the fact that, and I'm just going to take a look here, that Pierre Gasly finishes third, so he rakes in 15 points, and that Yuki, for the first time in a number of weeks, and I guess the last time that Yuki had been on the podium or had been in the points was race one in Bahrain. So I thought that was great. And I think the other piece too, because there was a lot of kind of commentary offline, and a lot of our listeners have been reaching out about the fact that Helmut Marko and the Red Bull team had relocated Yuki to Italy. And why had they done that? And I think some of the assumption was that maybe he was getting a little bit wild in England with all this freedom, but as it seems, it might actually be a slightly darker reason. And it sounds like Yuki may have been struggling with some mental health issues, and they wanted to bring him closer to some support mechanisms. So it was really great to see him finish in the points. But there was a point on lap 10 where they broadcast the radio where the team was asking him to, I quote, push harder on the tires, push flat out. And maybe I misheard this, but Yuki's response is, I am, shut up. I burst out laughing, and I had to rewind that and replay it a bunch of times, but I get such a kick out of Yuki. He's just such a personality and such a character. I was just so happy to see him and AlphaTauri have a great weekend.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was wonderful to see Pierre get on the podium once again. I think that quietly he's done some very good things since he was demoted or sent back to AlphaTauri from Red Bull a couple of years ago. But I mean, he has it in him, and it's going to be interesting to see where his career goes from here. Right? I mean, at some point, I think that Pierre is going to outgrow AlphaTauri. I mean, they're doing some wonderful things there, but it was really good to see Yuki have a good race, because we were both very, very impressed with the outing that he had in Bahrain, and then he's struggled subsequently over the past several races. It was great to see him get back into a good position today, and hopefully he can build on that. And we'll see what happens at the next race, which is it France now? I've completely forgotten.
France, and it happens in a hurry. And I think I posted something to the effect that we have 3 Grand Prix in 4 weekends, or 4 Grand Prix in 5 weekends. There's a lot of there's a lot of F1 coming. And I think I posted the baby let's go meme, but there's reason to be excited if you're a Formula One fan, because it comes fast. More puns. It comes fast and furious as we head into the summer break.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mark, that's all we got for tonight, this afternoon. Thank you all for listening. Thank you guys for checking in on the live stream on YouTube. Thank you for the tweets and the comments and everything like that. That's wonderful. We're going to sign off now, but we'll be back in a couple of days. Until then, if you want to get in touch, by all means, do so. Give us a follow on Twitter at @ScuderiaF1Pod, or send us an email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. If you like the show, please, by all means, go on to Apple Podcasts or wherever you download, listen to your podcast, and enjoy them, and leave us a nice rating and review. We would very much appreciate that, and it's a great way to help grow the show and share it with other fans. And with that, I'm running out of steam here. I need another cup of coffee. Anyways, on that note, we're going to wrap it up. Take care, guys. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you again soon. Bye for now.